Welcome to our February series of Westminster seminars. We are delighted to welcome back Dr. Elaine France, professor of history at Kent State University. She, over the next 4 weeks, will talk to us about
being Sarah, police. Hang on just 1 second. We're still chitty-chatting in the chapel.
Okay, I'm happy to start again when everyone calms down. Give me the signal.
Okay, folks, we're ready to start. Go for it.
Okay. Welcome to our February series of Westminster seminars. We are delighted to welcome back Dr. Elaine France, professor of history at Kent State University. Over the next 4 weeks, she will talk to us about being police, being policed, the history of crime and control in Pittsburgh. And now let's welcome Elaine and get started.
Click it on. Can everybody hear me? Sarah, am I good?
You're good.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Awesome. Okay, great. Well, welcome everybody. I'm really excited to be back here. And I'm really excited to be talking about this particular topic because I am right now writing a book about history and the history of policing in Pittsburgh. And right now I'm actually working on the chapter about policing in Pittsburgh before 1816. So this is actually, this is like, it was very dovetail-y with what it is that I'm working on right now. And I'm really excited to get a chance to talk about it. So you're definitely going to get a talk that is hot off the press. I'm going to set my timer so that I have a sense, because this is a fresh talk. Okay, and we'll see how well that works. This is the world premiere. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And my actual specialty, my research specialty is late 19th, early 20th. So this is the first time I've actually reached back this far to work on the history of this period, but I found it really, really interesting. So let's get started. So basically what I'm really interested in is thinking through what the police is, and particularly thinking about it through the lens of the Pittsburgh police. But I'm hoping that ultimately this study is going to have a broader interest than just Pittsburgh. So I want to think about what the institution of the Pittsburgh police is for, you know, where it comes from. But then I also really am interested in the question of how do we think through the role of the police officer? And their experiences, their lived experiences, their job and how they feel about it, you know, how they've encountered it. And also the question of people who are policed, you know, how is it that folks on the street, you know, who are the more frequent, you know, more frequently interact with the police, you know, how is it that they feel and have felt in time, and how has that encounter changed over time? So that's what the basic book is about. And so we'll start at the very beginning. And I love starting at the very beginning, because the thing about policing is that it feels very inevitable now. It feels very entrenched and inevitable, and it feels very obvious that it should be the way that it is, right? But it actually has a really long history, and there were times when it wasn't inevitable and obvious. And so what we're going to be talking about today is a period when they were really just the police, and in this case, it's the constable who's going to fill the role of police for most of this period. the closest we have to police, the constable, is really kind of a guy standing there trying to get control of things. You know, nobody assumes that he's in control. In fact, he really doesn't have very much power. You know, he's being challenged from the left and from the right, and he's trying to impose some sort of order, and he's trying to figure out what kind of order to impose. And everybody is trying to figure out whether they're going to listen to him. And so this is the period when that happens. And I find it actually really fascinating because it kind of, it takes the figure of the police and it sort of, you know, it throws him into a little bit of chaos right at the very beginning. And I find that really interesting. So first of all, I want to tell you what the job of constable was, because the job of constable is much older than the city of Pittsburgh, right? The job of constable actually goes back to the Roman Empire. And the term constable means originally was the attendant of the stable, attendant to the stable. But basically through, you know, the ancient world, the medieval world, or much of the ancient world, the medieval world, the early modern world, there have been constables in Western culture. And basically what the constable has done has changed over time, but it's remained fairly consistent. I'm going to focus on England, right? Because the folks we're going to be talking about are going to be largely coming from England. But the constable basically in England in the period right before people were coming over, let's say take the 1700s in England, the constable was a ceremonial position. Okay. And it's actually going to remain that way in Pittsburgh too. The constable is going to parade around with a staff sometimes, like when the court is in session, there's going to be a guy ringing a bell, and then parading behind him is going to be the judge, and the constable is going to be in there with his staff. So on the one hand, the constable sort of represents law and order. But then the constable has other very concrete jobs. The constable works for the justice of the peace, and is paired with the justice of the peace. The justice of peace gets to tell the constable, which is today we call it the magistrate district judge, right? The justice of the peace gets to tell the constable what to do, gets to issue warrants, and then the constable is to serve those warrants. The constable also does a lot of civil functions, like the constable attaches property. If somebody owes a debt, that the constable can attach their property. The constable also assesses and collects fines from people if they commit violations that are met by fines. The constable sometimes has a job of collecting taxes, but sometimes not. The constable also, when he serves warrants to arrest people, when the justice of peace gives him a warrant to arrest somebody, the constable has the job of finding the person, locating them, and deciding whether to take them back to the jail. And sometimes he needs some help in doing that if they won't comply. Or whether to allow them to have a bail, you know, allow people to stand bond for them and they can stay out of jail until their court date. The constable also has the job usually, in fact, always, of keeping order in the town generally, even outside of what the magistrate tells him to do or the justice of peace tells him to do. The constable is supposed to take care of any sort of disorder that's brought to his attention. Frequently, the constable deals with drunken people, right? Or disorderly people. Frequently, the constable deals with children, right? Who are disorderly. Frequently, the constable deals with poor people, you know, who aren't supposed to be in the town, you know, and it's his job to drive them out of the town so that the town doesn't have to, you know, feed them. The constable, it's often the constable's job to deal with, and particularly during this period, to deal with animals. The constable is often charged with rounding up animals which are loose and causing problems, particularly pigs. The constable also cleans up the, you know, if there's some sort of really gross thing and like disgusting thing, you know, on the street, like there's an animal carcass or there's some sort of somebody's making beer and, you know, there's like a, you know, some sort of byproduct of whatever they're making. And that person somehow isn't responsible for cleaning it up. It's a constable's job to make sure that that's cleaned up so that the constable has to like haul away the dead bodies and like deal with any sort of what they call noxious liquors. You know, anything that's gross, right? The constable sort of has to deal with it. The constable usually is appointed. We're going to see during this time, he becomes an elected position, but usually he's an appointed position. And usually he just serves for a year. And he's usually unpaid. He's unpaid, except for he can be paid through fees. So some of the things that he does, many of the things he does, he gets a small fee. Now, if you're familiar with today's magistrate district judge system, it's the same, right? Constables today aren't paid. They're elected, but usually they're appointed because nobody runs. And they're also paid through fees for the services that they do. So it's a consistent system. So that's basically what a constable is. So I want to talk today about five reasons that you would not have wanted to be a constable in this period. And believe me, you definitely would not have wanted to be a constable, and they didn't want to either. And we'll get to that. But reason one is that it wasn't clear at the beginning that there should be constables at all. There were actually competing systems. And particularly when you look at, you know, the first people who were at the Forks were Indigenous people. And Indigenous people, of course, had a system that didn't involve constables at all. And we won't go into a lot of detail of this because it's not constables, right? But basically you basically have this area populated from the 1720s. You have Indigenous people coming back to this region. For a long time before that, it was pretty much empty because folks were fleeing from the Haudenosaunee power, you know, in the east. And so basically the area that became Pittsburgh was unpopulated for several decades. And then around the 1720s, you have the Shawnee, you have the Lenape, we call the Delaware, you have the Mingo, who are a Seneca group, who are also Haudenosaunee or Iroquois. They start coming back around the 1720s, and they're coming back because of the fur trade. They're trying to make money with the fur trade. And then pretty soon at that same time, you have fur traders who come out to live with them. You have some really famous ones like George Croghan, who lives not too far from Pittsburgh in a place called Logstown. But basically during this early period, the way that they deal with law and order is consensual, collaborative. What they do is when somebody, say, kills somebody who's within a Algonquin, one of these groups, but it's also true really of the Iroquois or the Haudenosaunee. They basically call together all related parties and they have a long talk, really long. And people, you know, Europeans who are witnessing this in first contact are like, whoa, they really meet for a long time. So they'll sit down and all the parties involved on both sides will decide what has to happen as a response to this violation of order. So if somebody murdered somebody or somebody took something or, you know, whatever, it's serious enough, they'd have a long, long meeting. And usually what would end up happening, and there was nobody who was in charge. So sometimes there was somebody called a peace chief, and that person might preside over the meeting, but that person didn't have any power. And so nobody could say you are required to come to a consensus. If they did come to a consensus, usually that consensus was that the aggrieved party received some sort of gift from the other party, from the party that had harmed them. And they decided what that gift would be. And that gift actually came not from the person who had harmed them, but from their entire family, the people who are closest to them. So it's actually really different. And then if they didn't agree, if nobody, they couldn't come to a consensus on this, then they would just have to fight it out, right? Then there was no way that the, you know, the group that the leadership could force them to come to this, to any sort of agreement. But they usually did come to some sort of agreement where one side would give some sort of thing of value to the aggrieved party. And that was really how they did things. We actually have a quote from William Penn. He says, and this is from 1682, he says, "The justice they have is pecuniary. In case of any wrong or evil fact, be it murder itself, they atone by feasts and presents of their wampum, which is proportioned to the offense or person injured or the sect they are of." So this system is the system that is in place. It actually is, it's really different than the way we think about things, because it's not interested in individual responsibility, right? It's not interested particularly in justice. It's interested in restoration of order, right? It's interested in how can we get to where we can all move ahead again, but nobody has to be punished, right? So it was a very different system. And this was a system that was in place before any sort of constables arrived. And it was also the system that a lot of Europeans worked within. So people like George Croghan and others, Europeans who were early traders here, they had to work within this system. And even when there were violations between Europeans and indigenous peoples, they would have to at first use that sort of indigenous system. And so that was really the system that was in place until enough soldiers got here, right? You know, there was a time, right? And that's going to be, you know, with the Seven Years' War, that the balance of power is going to shift, and there's going to be enough, you know, physical power on the side of Europeans in this region that Europeans begin to be able to dictate the terms of the justice system, you know, more generally speaking. But one reason that you would not want to be a constable is that everybody is sort of, oh, and I should also say, this system of gift giving, a sort of restorative justice, you know, was also familiar to Europeans, because that definitely would have been a very common way things were done, even though constables existed and these kind of like more formal ways of resolving differences existed in Europe for many, many years before this, for centuries. It was very common in Europe for parties to resolve things by giving gifts, right? You know, by and through social groups coming together, families coming together and negotiating with each other and having exchange of gifts to cover the violation. That was actually something which was not that uncommon in Europe. And it was also something which even happened in the colonies among the whites. Sometimes it's just not worth it to get the justice system involved. It's something that probably happens now still, right, to some extent. You know, sometimes people choose to deal with things sort of informally, you know, through making it right and kind of giving those gifts. So one reason you might not want to become a constable is that everybody doesn't agree that constables even should have authority. And that's going to cause some problems for early constables. Okay, so we're going to get now to reason. Oh, and this is just an image of, this is not actually from Western Pennsylvania. You're going to see some of these images today are not exactly from the Pittsburgh region, because there was hardly anybody out here. And so there just aren't very many, very many images. But this is actually from Eastern Pennsylvania, but these are Shawnees in Eastern Pennsylvania, and they're actually meeting with, in this case, it's Swedish Swedish Europeans who are trading with them. Okay, so can we get to the next slide? Reason two. Okay, this is a constable. This is an image of the constable from the mid 1700s, but it's not Pittsburgh. It's actually a British constable. And you could tell because he's so well fed, right? We were pretty scrappy in Pittsburgh at this, you know, at this moment. Anybody in Pittsburgh would be pretty fit, right? Because they'd have to be. So the government during this time was messy and jurisdiction was unclear. So even once you start having the presence of the armies, you know, coming out with the Seven Years' War, first of all, of course, you know, you have the French, you have the English, but you actually have a multiplicity of groups of people that claim to be in charge. And so during the period, say between 1754 and 1780, at least 9 entities were able to persistently threaten and use violence to assert what they claim to be legitimate authority. If you think about it, during this, you know, brief period, you have the Shawnees, you have the Lenapes or the Delawares, you have the Mengos, the Senecas, and all three of these, they often collaborate, but they also work separately. Sometimes they're in dispute with each other. You have the French army coming in. You have the British army. You have the Virginia, and the British army is actually represented largely by the Virginia militia during this time. You have civil officials coming in then, and you have civil officials who are going to come in from two different colonies, because nobody knew whether Pittsburgh was part of Pennsylvania or Virginia. It hadn't been decided yet. And so both of them actually are claiming the right to rule Pittsburgh. So if you happen to live in Pittsburgh during this time, you really had all nine of these entities claiming some sort of authority. Now, there's only two of these entities that would have constables, right? And that is the Virginia and the Pennsylvania government. But they're both going to have constables in Pittsburgh at the same time. They have competing slates of courts and constables. They have competing justices of pieces, they have competing constables. And so there's actually constables during this period of time. There's something called Dunmore's War, which we don't need to get into a lot of detail about, but basically there's a period of time in the early 1770s, from 1771, really through 1776, right, when it's radically unclear whether Virginia constables or Pennsylvania constables are in charge. And in fact, they're arresting each other. They're arresting each other. And when they arrest each other, they're sending each other back to their, you know, the court of the county that they say rules Pittsburgh, right, which could be Bedford. You know, for part of this, they're going, they having to, you know, if you arrest somebody in Pittsburgh, you have to take them to like Bedford, you know, which you'd have to really think about whether it's worth it, right, to arrest that person if it means literally some group of people is going to have to take them to Bedford, right? Or after that, it's Westmoreland County, and I think it's Hannistown. So it's a little bit closer, but it's still 100 miles away, you know, on horseback, right? And it's even further if you believe that the Virginians are in charge, that's actually in Stanton. So you'd actually have to, if you arrested somebody, you'd have to haul them to Stanton, right? To have, you know, to get to the justice of the peace and to sort of stand trial there. So people had to decide, and we have some, you know, knowledge of how people navigated this. Most Pittsburghers preferred the Virginian system because Virginia was selling property cheaper than Pennsylvania was. They both were selling the same land, right? They both were selling lots in Pittsburgh, and Virginia's lots were a lot cheaper than Pennsylvania's lots were. So if you bought Virginia's lots, you had to agree to abide by Virginia's rules. So most people tended to favor Virginia. The other advantage that Virginia had during this period was that they actually decided to send troops. So they actually decided in 1774, and of course, why can't the Pennsylvanians send troops in the 1770s? Why don't they just do the same? Anybody know why Philly doesn't just send some troops to occupy Pittsburgh, like, because they're Quakers, right? So they're actually not going to do it. They refuse, right? They're not interested in sending militia out. But Virginia actually sends militia out. They send 100 to 200 men. And they actually name one of the militiamen, this is in 1774, they actually name one of the militiamen a justice of the peace. So that he himself becomes the representative of, but he's the head also of the militia. So he's a soldier. He represents a militia, but he's also the kind of representing civil government. But another reason why you would not want to be a constable at this time, because they did have constables, but the constables are literally having to sort of fight for their authority, you know, amongst themselves, and also against the sort of, to some extent, against the military government, right? Because the military government is claiming the right to discipline civilians, right? And the constables are trying to assert except for in the case of Connolly, who is both a constable and, you know, the military. So that kind of ties them together. But often there's kind of a conflict during this period between the rights of soldiers to discipline people and the rights of constables to discipline people. So it's, again, it's sort of a messy spot for a constable to be in. Okay. So there is a third reason that you would not want to be a constable during this time. And that, if you can go up to number three, yes, the constable faced constant competition from informal justice. And what that means, it's different than what I was saying before. I was saying before that there was the kind of indigenous system, which also existed in medieval Europe, of giving gifts to resolve problems, right? But this is vigilantism. So the other kind of system that constables were constantly competing against was just people taking the law into their own hands. And you could really see how this would be tempting. I mean, when you think about how far away the courts were, you know, how much do you really want to haul somebody all the way to, you know, Bedford, or haul somebody, you know, especially if the person is resisting, right? Haul somebody all the way to Stanton, right? You really don't want to do that. And so it's very, very tempting to take the law into your own hands. And plus, these constables are new. You know, these constables, you know, starting in 1771, you have some constables on the ground. But where do they come from? Like, who are they? Do you recognize their authority? And so constables really have a hard time competing with just a group of guys who say, I'm going to take the law into my own hand. And the best example of that, I think the one we're most familiar with, is the Whiskey Rebellion here in 1794. But I want to jump back even a little bit earlier and say, like, if you look at Pittsburgh gets a newspaper starting in the 1780s. And one of the main things that's in that Pittsburgh Gazette is ads for lost property or ads for people who have committed legal violations. And they're giving rewards, and they're saying, look, somebody stole my watch, or usually it's your horse, right? Somebody stole my horse, or somebody stole my watch, or somebody stole, you know, a stack of hats from, you know, that I was trying to sell, or, you know, something like that. I will give you $20 if you will recover this and put that person in a jail or bring them to me. I will give you a $20 reward. Or recover the hats. I don't care if you get the person. You know, people have different kinds of terms. But so at the very beginning, it's very common. You're going to see these kinds of ads all the way up to, say, the 1820s. It's very common for people to say, we're not going to count on a constable to do anything, right? We're just going to hope that just regular people go out and catch this guy, and then I'm going to give them a reward. So that's a very, very common, common form of justice. One of my favorite stories from Pittsburgh in this period is actually a little bit later in 1806. You have a constable who he gets attacked. So he's trying to enforce a rule. He's trying to enforce a rule about horses. You're not supposed to have your horses straying through the city. And so he is trying to deal with that. And then he goes to bed at night, and somebody throws a rock through his window. And so he goes and complains to the town council, and the town council takes out an ad and puts in a reward. Like, could somebody catch these people who attacked our constable? Like, we'll give you $50 if you'll catch the people that attacked our constable, right? So it's very, if you think about it, the constable during this period is not in a very strong, very strong position, right? But when you think about the Whiskey Rebellion, and we won't go into all the details of the Whiskey Rebellion, but basically the Whiskey Rebellion was a wholesale rejection of civil authority, right? You know, it was kind of a decision. Some people actually compared it at the time to the French Revolution, you know, and thought it was kind of going in that direction. But it was when the people of Pittsburgh are basically like, we don't think the government is fair. We're going to actually form a militia of our own. They actually mobilized an existing militia, the Mingo Creek militia. They march right out of Green Tree, right? I think people are probably pretty familiar with the Whiskey Rebellion because it was right here. But basically it was a total lawlessness that took hold in the town of Pittsburgh. So this happens in the Whiskey Rebellion is 1794. The first elected magistrate in Pittsburgh is actually 1794. So, or the first elected constable. So until 1794, constables are appointed. In 1794, they decide to start electing them. They elect this one guy, the first constable, who's Samuel Morrison. And then within a month, the Whiskey Rebellion explodes and peaks. And the most fascinating thing about reading, when you read about the Whiskey Rebellion, is that, you know, whose name never comes up? And people have written all sorts of detailed accounts right at the time, you know, who was doing what during the Whiskey Rebellion and which group of people were marching against which group of people. And it was a mess, right? Whose name never comes up? Samuel Morrison. He's totally irrelevant to the Whiskey Rebellion. So he's elected constable, and then the Whiskey Rebellion happens, and he just like hides or runs away, or just is like, I don't know, it's not my problem, right? So he is the elected constable, but he understands it's not relevant who's constable when there's armies of people marching around, you know, attacking the excise people, right? So I have a couple of other images here if you wanna go forward here. Okay, this is an image of what I was talking about earlier with these kind of ads kind of saying, somebody stole 15 watches, right? You can see Pittsburgh is, you know, starting to move along there by 1801. There, you know, but again, they're not counting on the constable to catch it. Okay, could have the next one. This is a liberty pole, and we're not going to talk about that just because of constraints of time, but I do want to say that Pittsburgh became sort of famous for liberty poles. And this this particular one is in New York City. This is maybe the first liberty pole. It's from the 1760s. But we actually had our own Tea Party in Pittsburgh in 1794 when a bunch of people came in and they represented the revolutionary government. And they came in, I think, from Bedford. So a little kind of militia from Bedford comes in, and they find somebody who's selling tea illegally. And they actually, they take the tea, they get the person to confess, they run they build a liberty pole, which is just a symbol of resistance to the British at this time. It's a symbol of resistance to oppression. They run the tea up the Liberty Pole and they set it on fire. And it's a lot of tea. It's like, you know, trunks full of tea, but they set it on fire at the top of this pole. And they actually then write to the Continental Congress and they say that what they had done. And they said, we're really sorry that we didn't tar and feather these people. Given the fight between Virginia and Pennsylvania and how it's playing out right now in Pittsburgh, we thought it was wise not to make the soldiers mad up at the fort, right? And so we've decided to just, you know, burn the tea and not, you know, tar and feather the people. Hope that's okay, you know. But there's this like really great, but again, there's just like this, there's this sort of total vigilante justice sort of, you know, vibe that's going on that really continues through this entire period that we're talking about, and the constables really have to sell themselves as a better option than the sort of vigilante solution. Is there one more here? Yeah, this is an image of from the Whiskey Rebellion itself, representing Pittsburgh scene, and it was actually created in 1794. And that's an excise man, a whiskey excise man. Maybe it's Neville, you know, of Bower Hill. These are two farmers back there, and they're trying to catch him in order to tar and feather him. And he's trying to run away. And then some sort of devil, I don't know, gets him. And then they hang him. And they explode a thing of powder underneath his body as they're hanging him, right? Guy's not an artist, but again, you could really see there's not a lot of respect for authority. And this guy isn't technically a constable, but, you know, he's an excise man. But you can see that there's just not a lot of respect in general for any sort of authority here, and it would be difficult for constables as well. You understand why the constable hid, or you know, was totally AWOL, you know, during the entire Whiskey Rebellion. Okay, let's go to reason four. Okay, reason four is that constables, the job of constables really, was to enforce the use of communal resources. When you really look at what the constables did, what they largely were doing was deciding who got to use common resources once the town got big enough that there was a limitation of sort of public goods, right? So once everybody had to use the same square, you know, everybody had to use the same streets, you had to decide what was the appropriate use for them, who got to use them, and who got to decide how they could use them, right? And what the constable is really doing when you look day to day at the kinds of people he has to interact with, is he's saying, you're not allowed to have this kind of animal can't be free on the street anymore, because it's disruptive to other people who want to use the street in other ways. Like, you want to let your hogs run through the street, as they totally did in Pittsburgh. But now that people have nice gardens, the hogs are getting into the gardens. And so the people with the nice gardens say, you can't have your hog run through the streets, but you want your hog to run through the streets because that's how your hog eats, right? And then you want to eventually eat the hog, and that's how you're feeding your family. So the constable largely has to make discretionary choices about who gets to use the public goods, right? And whether the constable is, you know, enforcing, you know, that kind of behavior, or let's say you're a person who likes to drink, and you're a person who likes to use the tavern, and you like to walk down the street from the tavern back to your house, and you're drunk and you're loud. The constable is supposed to stop you from using the street in that way, because somebody else is in their house and they would rather not have the streets be noisy, right? Or something like that, right? So the constable is always making sort of discretionary choices about who gets to decide how to use the streets. Now, we still do that today, but now it's sealed in tradition. It's always been like that, right? So it's very clear, you know, why we make certain kinds of decisions and not. But at this time, the constable sort of, somebody had to decide, no more pigs in the streets. Right? No more pigs in the streets. And they're telling, and that's, the constable didn't decide. The constable is just following the directions of the magistrates, right? The magistrates and then the council who originally makes the rules. But these laws seem new, right? Are new. And so people aren't inclined to just defer to them. People are inclined to question them. And if you think about who's in Pittsburgh at this time, it's a frontier community. People have come out to this area precisely because they want to be able to take advantage of the common goods, right? That's why you come to a frontier, is that all the people haven't claimed use of the common goods, that they're available to new people who come in and use them. But of course, the first people who get there, their first job is to get control of those common goods and stop them from being, common goods any longer, right? So the constable's real job during this period is very largely being a sort of, I'm gonna say policing, right? Like, who gets to use the streets, you know, or who gets to use the coal, which is visible on the cliffs, right? And people like to burn it. Well, who gets to dig that out? Right. All sorts of, you know, who gets to use the waterway? Can you throw your animal carcasses, if you're a butcher, into the river? Or does that impede other people's use of the waterway? If you're a 12-year-old boy, this was a big issue, can you wash and be naked in the river to do your bathing? Or does that impede other people's, you know, use of the, because they don't want to like look at you, you know, so do we need to get the naked people out of the river? You know, do we need to get, the dead bodies out of the river, the dead carcasses out of the river? Like who gets to use all that stuff? The constable is very largely the person who's patrolling that at a time when a lot of people don't think it should be patrolled. Okay. And we're going to almost to our last one. Reason five, people disadvantaged. Oh, I forgot about this. Sorry about that. Did I miss something? Yeah, here we go. Let's look at this before we go into reason five, which is, this is actually the first time we get the words of a Pittsburgh constable, that I can find. And this is a guy named James Chambers, who is a Pittsburgh constable for a few times in the 1780s. He's actually a repeat constable. And he decides he's going to run for, he was an appointed constable because it's the 1780s. He's going to run for coroner. And so he actually puts an ad. This is his political ad where he's going to run for coroner. And he says, I'm running for coroner because I've given people pleasure as constable. I was a good constable. People liked me. So now I think you will elect me as coroner, where he could make some money, right? You make a lot of money as coroner. And one of the things he says up here is, he says, one thing you've learned from me from my performance as a constable is, quote, the hand of oppression would by me never be uplifted against the afflicted widow or helpless orphan. And that's actually really important in a coroner, because the coroner can make decisions that determine how much money where the money is going to be going from the estate of the dead person. But he's actually making the case that as constable, he has shown that he's not going to oppress the poor. Right. And so actually there is really a sense that one thing about these early police or constables is that they're doing a kind of balancing act between the interests of different portions of the population. And it has to be it's really important that they not, do things like oppress the poor. Okay. So let's go now to reason number five. And this is probably the biggest reasons why you would not have wanted to be a constable, is that constables constantly, and I don't think you'll be surprised by this at this time, now that we've said all the other things, they're constantly being attacked, physically attacked, right? Constables are constantly attacked, right? If you're a constable, people will fight you, right? And this is going to be true. I don't want to, when we look ahead to the next chunk, we're going to be talking about up to the Civil War. Constables get beaten up all the time, right, while doing their job. It's part of being a constable, right? And in fact, I don't want to give too much away, but we have a mayor that says, look, you're a constable, it's your job to be beat up. We actually have this is actually sort of like what constables do, is they represent the law at a time when the law is a little shaky, right? And then people are going to fight back. People fight back all the time. We've seen the example of, this constable in 1806, his name was William Cecil, who gets, somebody throws some stuff through his window, because he had been trying to enforce something about livestock, the horse ordinance. We don't have too much information about constables being attacked in Pittsburgh this early. But what we do have is a couple of really good examples from Philadelphia. And the reason this is Philadelphia is like so much bigger. Like Pittsburgh during this time in 1800, anybody want to guess how many people are in Pittsburgh in 1800-ish? Yeah, not bad actually, yeah. 1500. Like 1500 people in Pittsburgh. So it's like really small. And I don't know how many people are in Philly, but it's just like a lot. Like Philadelphia is just nothing like Pittsburgh, right, during this time. But even in Philadelphia, in 17, it's very common for constables to be physically attacked. So in 1779, there's a newspaper article that comes out pleading that Philadelphians treat watchmen with civility, and complaining that recently they have been, quote, maliciously treated and put in danger of their lives. And it's just a very, very common during this time for constables to be attacked. And yet during this time, starting in the 1780s, the people who are really serving as constable, who are being elected as constable, they're fairly prominent Pittsburghers. Like they're not wealthy, because nobody out here is really wealthy, but they're Pittsburgh wealthy, right? They're like the most prominent people in Pittsburgh. They get elected, they serve their year as constable. They are the elite. And so this guy, William Cecil, who gets something through his window, like he's the big saddler in town. He makes the saddles. He's one of the wealthier people, right, in this small community. So these wealthy men are sort of being forced to rotate through this role where they're getting attacked, they're getting beaten up. And we know that even in the 1820s, that the elites in Pittsburgh are still having to, and sometimes even the 1830s, are having to themselves go out and fight for order, like physically fight for order. You actually have a mayor in the 1820s, we'll be talking about, who actually goes out and like physically fights in the marketplace alongside the constable to maintain order. But what happens during this time is that the wealthy people themselves are the constables. And they're actually having to get out there and like, you know, impose the order themselves. And it's really a mess. So the real, you know, I think the real reason why you wouldn't want to be constable is that nobody's going to just automatically defer to you. And then even we'll talk about this, even when you don't defer to a constable, even when you fight with a constable, and you really aren't going to be punished for it. Like there's no system of law that's going to really penalize you for fighting with a constable. It's kind of expected that that's what's going to happen. So basically, it shouldn't be a surprise that when Pittsburgh finally reorganizes in 1816, Pittsburgh becomes formally a city and reorganizes, it shouldn't be a surprise that one of the first things they do is totally change the system of policing, right? And they start, it's really by 1816 that they really start moving to a totally new system of policing where the person who's kind of on the front line is not going to be a sort of elected elite. Right. So I think at this point I'll stop and take questions. And I had to cut out a lot, but yeah. So yeah.
So until just the end there, you never mentioned police or sheriffs. Were there none? Did this all fall on the constable?
There's no police. So the constable becomes the police. Right. The constable is going to start to be called. We'll talk about sheriff, but the constable will become the police. They start to be called the police like in the 1830s and 1840s.
So it evolves to that.
They gradually, yeah, come to be called the police. And in fact, at this time, if you said police, you actually would think about French police. That the word police, whenever they would use the word police in the newspapers, they're talking about France. And they're talking about critically. They think it's like the police are like part of this like overweening, over-centralized state. So the term police had a negative connotation until like the 20s or 30s, 1820s or 30s. So there's no police, they're constables. They don't do anything like patrol.
How about sheriffs?
There are sheriffs. Yes, there are sheriffs. Sheriffs are as old as constables, right? Or almost as old as constables. There are sheriffs. Sheriffs run the jail. They always do. Sheriffs can get involved. They could go out. Sheriffs have the authority to go out and arrest people. Generally speaking, they don't. Sheriffs can send out constables. They have the authority. If a sheriff gives a warrant to a constable, they have to go out. Generally speaking, they don't. Sheriffs tend to be primarily interested in property, like they're the ones who get to auction off property, right, and stuff like that. They tend to be extremely elite, and for most of the period we're talking about now, they're very far away because they're in the county seat, right? And so until 1788, when we get Allegheny County, the sheriff is going to be off in Stanton or off in Bedford, right, or often Hannah's town. But even when the sheriff is close by, you rarely see them. And they do have the authority. They can do it, but they actually traditionally don't, you know, become involved in those. Occasionally, like if there's a, if something becomes a riot, so like if instead of having like a criminal attack or something like that, you have a riot, you often do call in the sheriff at that time. He will show up. But as far as like day-to-day problems, the sheriff almost never shows up at all in the records. So I've been interested in that question myself. Yeah.
When did the idea of punishment, once the constable caught somebody, what would happen?
Yeah. So we're before, one thing we're before is we're sort of before the period of incarceration. So the jail is only to hold people until trial. People wouldn't be jailed as a punishment. Pennsylvania, because we're Quaker, is going to be one of the first states to shift to incarceration as a means of punishment, as a kinder means of punishment than physical, you know, whipping. You know, at this time, we do have whipping posts. So like when we set up, you know, and it, when you think about Bedford, you think about Stanton or Hannahstown, or when Pittsburgh, a jail is built in Pittsburgh in 1788, they have a whipping post. And they do have a pillory. So you could be, you have to stand on the pillory, you know, the kind of public shame. They also will cut off your ears. You know, they were, you know, and even in Pittsburgh, nail them to the wall behind you while you're up on the pillory. Not every time, but, you know, if you do something, you know, there was a, you know, they had a lot of very, gruesome punishments, right? But Pittsburgh, I mean, Pennsylvania, one thing that they did really early on is refuse to have the death penalty, which like at England at this time, there were many different offenses for which you could be hanged. English law gets transplanted to the colonies. So mainly we just pick up common law. And we're just following the English law, except for where we've explicitly decided to do something different. But Pennsylvania, actually, one thing it does do is limit the number of things that can have the death penalty to only murder and treason, you know, or something like that. But it basically, they really ramp down the physical punishment. And by the 1820s, they're going to be, you know, with the Eastern Penitentiary and everything like that, they're going to be going, they're really innovative in trying to have a sort of less physical kind of punishment. There's dunking too. They did dunk people. Yeah.
Back before there was a formal code of justice, was there sort of a frontier independence or a self-imposed code of conduct? If the average, if there are only 1,500 people, how did the average person feel safe? Was it, were there gangs? Were there people didn't go over and steal your chicken because of the code of conduct? Or was there a mafia that you looked to have this particular person protect you? Or how did you have a sense of feeling safe back in the early time?
Yeah, no, that's a really, really, really good question. And of course, our problem is when you think about historians and records, who's really good at keeping records is courts. Who's really not good at keeping records is groups of guys who go and attack their neighbor because he's done something wrong. You know, so we actually don't really know. But what we do know is, for instance, take the Whiskey Rebellion, because that's something where we ended up getting a lot of people actually wrote about what happened on the ground. A bunch of men would get together, paint their faces black, you know, sometimes put on like Indian feathers, white men, And they would go and attack the person who had offended them, you know, by trying to collect the whiskey tax, right? This was a very common, you know, having this kind of vigilante justice, very, very common at this time. So basically you blacken your face usually, maybe you put on like Indian, which is the tea party, right? You know, the classic tea party, right? And then you go out and you attack the person who's committing the wrong. That's very, very common. Sometimes, you know, one of the images we saw before of the Whiskey Rebellion, you could see somebody being ridden on a rail. You know, you force somebody to sit naked on a, you cover them maybe with feathers, tar and feathers, you know, you force them to ride on a rail. It's very humiliating and very painful. It's also the tar, you know, just getting the tar off, and it's burning tar that's put on your body. You can get infected, you could die, you know, trying to, you know, from the results of those things. So, you know, so I think there was an awful lot of vigilante justice, but of course they're not going to record it. So we can't know how frequent it was, but I think it was probably very frequent. Yeah.
Anyone online with a question? John?
Perfect timing, huh? Yeah, you're sitting there not hopping the entire time. Yeah.
Are there any advantages to being a consul?
Oh, any advantages? Yeah, you get paid. Okay, so a couple things that are good about being constable during this period. You know, you would get fees for everything you did. And so you could, you know, every time you arrested a person, every time you got bond for a person, every time you drove a poor person out of town, you know, every time you, you know, actually got the most for driving a poor person out of town, which must have meant they didn't want to do it, you know, but, you know, every time that you did X thing, you could charge it up. You got mileage even, which, was significant. You know, so definitely you got paid. It's also, once it becomes an elected position, you know, it's a little bit prestigious, you know, to be the constable. You get to hang out with the council. But then also, if you didn't agree to be constable, which people often didn't, people were often elected in Pittsburgh and said, no, I won't serve, which you can totally imagine why they would do that. You then were fined. You had to pay a big fine. So I mentioned this guy who got attacked, you know, somebody threw a Cecil, William Cecil, somebody threw a rock through his window. He was actually the third person who had been asked to be constable that year. The first two had declined being constable. I think they probably knew what was coming because there had been an increase in efforts to police, you know, in 1806. And so they were like, yeah, no, I actually choose not to do this. But they paid fines. And then he stepped up and did it. He got the rock. But the advantage was he didn't have to pay the fine. So
if the constables were generally sort of part of the elite, mm-hmm. then who were the folks who resisted, harassed, and beat them? Were they just the rabble, or were they other folks who sought power, or just what?
I mean, I think largely it's, yeah, the up and coming people who, you know, so for instance, the people who needed to have their pigs in the street were people who didn't have pigsties, right? They didn't have enough property to have a pigsty, and they couldn't feed, they didn't have enough, you know, means to buy food for their pigs, and they hadn't enclosed their own garden. You know, and so those are the folks, you know, who are relying on the sort of use of the public spaces. At some points, you're actually going to have, we didn't talk about another important group of people, which is unfree labor. You know, at this point, you still have enslaved people in Pittsburgh, right? And you have, you know, indentured servants. You have children who are, you know, forced to work for their parents and, you know, in abusive situations and are trying to escape. And you have soldiers, right, who aren't allowed to leave. They're being soldiers, right? And one thing that the constable also did was catch these people and return them to their rightful, you know, to their masters. You know, so you actually have, you know, unfree people are often sort of clients or, you know, people who are resisting constables. I skipped one of the slides I had up there, but it's actually one of my favorites. It was from Philly. It was a Philly ad that said, if you can capture, it's from a constable and he's like, I just captured this. Or are you coming back to it? Is it maybe at the end? Maybe I didn't put, back one. Yeah, there we go. Here we go. Okay, so this one, this guy is a constable in Philly, or I'm sorry, he's in Chester County. And he actually says, this guy escaped from me. And I had been trying to catch him because he had assaulted another constable. So he was wanted for assault and battery of another constable, and I captured him, and then he escaped from me. So I'll give you a reward if you can capture him. But at the bottom, he says, whoever takes this person is desired to look sharp after him, as he is well used to escaping from constables, right? And so it's like, but yeah, so I mean, I think, you know, so, you know, often it's people who are, you know, kind of down and out, you know, people who are trying to take advantage of the chaos of the place, the sort of frontier society, in order to, you know, sort of be lawless. It was pretty easy to like steal someone's horse, right? You know, it was pretty easy to steal a big stack of hats, right? Because law and order was really pretty thin on the ground. So those are the folks that the constable is trying to sort of, you know, get under control.
Well, thank you very much. This has been fascinating, and we'll look forward to next week.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.